Welcome to the Declarations of War podcast. This is episode 62. Thanks for tuning in. We are your hosts, Lexi Card and CSM representative, Ali Ross.
Hey, guys.
Unfortunately, Ninja Turtle had a scheduling conflict, so he couldn't be here with us tonight, but it worked out all right. It makes room for the massive ego of our special guest, the prolific host of Crossing Zebras, Xander Fina.
Massive ego. Huge ego.
I'm glad we could fit all of you in here.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's always awesome doing somebody else's podcast because you have the realization that you don't have to spend hours editing it afterwards. And trust me, recording a podcast is infinitely more fun than editing a podcast.
And it's long overdue to have you on. You've had me on as a guest in Crossing Zebras several times, particularly when I was on the CSM, but it was always a good time, and I was glad we finally managed to get you on here.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. I think we've got a lot to talk about today as well.
Indeed. So some shout-outs. I want to give a shout-out to Mark Havoc and Abvit, who sent us great feedback about the Tech 1 versus Tech 2 Masterclass segment we did on the last show. Thanks for listening, guys, and keep at it. We're taking some of your suggestions for future Masterclasses.
And I want to give a very special and very heartfelt shout-out to the Valkyries of Night Corp and the Of Sound Mind Alliance. That's the corp I've been a part of for over a year now. They're the ones who brought me back into the game and taught me to fall in love with it. It has been a great year and a half, and I'm going to be moving on. So I'm going to miss all you guys. You're awesome, especially those of you who I've convinced to come listen to this podcast that I now co-host. And more on where I'm going later.
Well, I'm going to be pretty boring. I'm going to give a huge shout out to my fellow host of Crossing Zebras, Jeg Elsker, who is an absolute legend and an IT whiz kid, which is fantastic because I have zero skills when it comes to that. Also, all my bros in Zebra Corps. And a big shout out, I know we're going to talk about it in the next hour or so, but a big shout out to the guys in the SCL, the Syndicate Competitive League, who warmly welcomed myself and Alex into the fold this weekend, and I had a great time with those guys.
And of course, a shout out to our sponsor, Eve Timecode. EveTimecode.com. Buy 14 Eve Timecodes, get one free. Eve Timecode, where your business counts. If you'd like to advertise in Declarations of War, you can contact Alexei of Card, in-game, or through the site. Now, we're going to do things a little bit differently than normal, since Xander is the host of his own podcast, Crossing Zebras, who, you know, in addition to sharing a fairly large...
Number one podcast in all of EVE Online, CCP certified.
Yes. In addition to sharing, like, a massive portion of our listenership, you know, we also share space on welovefine.com/Eve, where our t-shirts are all sold. Of course, our design is better than his, but I'm sure people buy his too. You know, he's got his own cast, his own format. You're probably quite familiar with him. Rather than do an interview with Xander, we're just going to have sort of a rolling panel-y interviewee thing throughout the entire show. And I wanted to open that up by reading a letter from one of the people that I shouted out in my shoutouts, Mark Havoc, where Xander plays a prominent role. Hey, Alec. I just wanted to say I love your podcast, and I think you and Ninja and now Ali do a great show. I bounced in and out of EVE since 2011, but try to stay at least engaged with the meta game changes in some way. With the meta slash game changes in some way. I listen to your podcast when I drive between Tucson and Phoenix, Arizona, which I do somewhat regularly for work. Works out well that the show lengths and drive times are almost the perfect match. Anyway, you guys have inspired me to jump back into the game and brought a new level of excitement and understanding to it all. Thanks for dedicating your free time to the podcast. I'm again a paying subscriber to CCP because of it. So tell them that if you're making a bid to become the new number one CCP certified podcast and knock those zebra guys off their high horse, maybe you can even get an Ishikone watch scorp out of it, tongue face. From Mark Havoc. Thank you,
Mark.
There's
two things that we want to point out in that email. The first thing is that I almost get the impression he seriously thinks that Crossing Zebras is like a number one CCP certified podcast, which isn't exactly true. It's just kind of something that we say now and again. So just in case anybody thinks that that's true, I'm going to step out of character for one little second and say that's not true. We're not certified by CCP, but we will continue saying it. The second thing is the clear admission that declarations of war is still below crossing zebras in that email. So I'm very pleased you picked that one out, Alexiev.
I don't want to put you out, Xander. I know that being the number one CCP certified podcast, true or not true, is pretty much the only thing that you have going for you right now. And
it's my entire life.
I'm going to let you have it. I'm going to let you have it. Because we're all right. You know what I mean?
Thank you. I appreciate that. Very generous of you.
That's a very humble and generous person. So moving on, we had a poll like we do every show, and because of the content of the masterclass, hey, you know, how can Tech 1 weapon users like T1 railguns and T1 blasters, T1 lasers of various flavors, how do they work in fleets, and when's it like required to use Tech 2 weapons, and what are the advantages of it? So I was curious, what portion of our audience has Tech 1 weapons, does not have any Tech 2 weapons, and, you know, can't use them, is sort of stuck. So the question was, can you use a cruiser or battleship Tech 2 weapon system? 89% of our audience can. Only 5% cannot. Allie, what do you think about this?
Well, the problem that you run into with this, and the problem that we ran into when Sound was working with Noir in Providence, is that you have people who can all use a cruiser or T2 BS weapon system, but they can't all use the same cruiser or T2 weapon system. So what you end up with is you have three guys who can use Tech 2 autocannons, three guys who can use Tech 2 blasters, a couple of guys who train Tech 2 hams, and the one lone guy with Tech 2 sentries. Have fun putting them all in a fleet.
It can be a bit difficult, but, you know, it's not impossible. There are certain combinations of ships which do work together well. I mean, obviously, if you've got a one dude that can use, I don't know, Tech 2 medium blasters, say, and you're doing a shield fleet, yeah, if he can't fly like a Ferox or something, his ship things are going to be kind of limited, but you can sort of jury-rig a shield Brutix.
Navy Brutix.
It's not terrible.
That thing is so good.
A Navy Shield Brutix, you said? I've not tried it.
You can fit a whole bunch of DPS, a whole bunch of nano in the lows. The tank is pretty reasonable, and it does a whole hell of a lot of damage.
Have to give that a shot sometime. I really like the Shield Brutix that EMP was using.
See, the problem with this question is, if you train a T1 weapon system and you like that weapon system, and you know, whatever that may be, artilleries or autocannons or whatever, the chances are you will naturally try and fit the T2 variant into your skill plan further down the line. And if you haven't done so, the chances are you probably weren't that taken. Not in all cases, but I would suggest in the majority of cases, you probably weren't that taken in that particular weapon type in the first place. I mean, it's going to be different for different organizations. I'd imagine War is going to be very different to, for example, a CFC corporation. It's going to be very different to some wormhole dudes, but it's all going to come down to how well you screen out these guys in the recruitment process, I guess. But for us personally, in Zebra Corps, if a guy can't fly the fit properly, we would rather he flew tackle and learnt how we fly as a group, you know, get himself in comms, get integrated, find out how we work, and fly tackle until he can fly the correct fits properly.
Yeah, we're the same way. The only real difference between us and maybe a CFC type corp is that there's perhaps a higher degree of variance in the number of ships we bring. In other words, you know, if you have a null fleet, though, it's a Drake fleet or something like that, there's like your Drakes, and there's your interdictors, and there's your logistics, and then there's not terribly a lot of room for other stuff.
Because you're dealing with so many guys, you definitely want to try and streamline your fits if you're in an organization such as, you know, Goonswarm or Gentleman's Agreement or Razor or whoever. When you're dealing with so many people, it makes sense, the more people you have, to try and streamline your fits as much as possible to accommodate as high a percentage of those pilots as possible for each fit.
You got to keep it simple. And it's not just for on-field stuff. You also got to think at that level of the game, about the logistics, making sure that these things are stocked and distributable to all your pilots to make sure everybody has what they need, and potentially 3, 4, 5 copies of it in case it all gets blown up.
And that, I think, is where people start bringing in Tech One weapon systems, or allowing the use of Tech One weapon systems, because you want to make sure that you can, if you have only one ship type that's available, you end up with a whole bunch more people who aren't going to be able to, they aren't going to be able to ship into a complementary fleet ship type. The only complementary one is going to be TAC or Logi. So you end up in a gang where you have like 1/4 of your fleet in a DPS ship, in like a large scale fleet. And that's not really sustainable. We've seen that with CBA when they have, you know, 200 man zealot fleet, 60 of them are zealots, 60 of them are tackle frigates.
You know, I mean, the thing with that is it's less of an issue of that. It's more of a thing if we want to get the maximum performance per pilot, because we don't have 200 pilots to work with. We're lucky if, you know, we have 20. So if you have like max drone skills, even if we are flying a zealot fleet, I'm quite fine with them being in an Ishtar, as long as that Ishtar is kitted out to hit at the range that the zealots can hit at. If it has the same or greater damage application profile than the zealot, and it can tank as well as the zealots, that's fine with us. So like, that's cool. Or if it's particularly complementary, like 1 or 2 sacrileges in that fleet in our minds isn't bad, because yes, the sacrileges can't say anchor on the zealots or anything like that, but what they can do is fly 40 kilometers ahead of the zealots and scram web paint, etc. stuff, and have a much bigger tank so they can absorb the fire that'll come at them from being closer to the enemy fleet, whereas the rest of us can sit back and blap.
And the thing is, as well, how far are you going to be realistically from getting that T2 weapon skill? I mean, we're asking you to maybe sit in a semi or a guardian for 3 weeks while you train up that skill, and then you can fly the T2. It tends to be
depends what size T2 it is, and this is one of the things that, I mean, post Rubicon, yeah, the maximum is going to be about 3 weeks of training. Before Rubicon, it takes 50 days to go from Tech 1 to Tech 2 on a large. It's a lot of time. It's a significant training investment, and it's especially a significant training investment when you can hit 2 or 3 other Tech 2 things in that time. So it's like, oh, I could get Tech 2 large weapons, or I could get hull upgrades 5 and pick 2 other easy level 5 supports.
Another thing to keep in mind is that this question usually affects, not always, but generally speaking, a younger player who may not even have the support skills for gunnery, missiles, or engineering, electronics, etc. And that may have a higher priority.
Absolutely, and that's what we find, actually. It tends not to be the weapon systems that comes down, you know, that becomes the issue, certainly in Gentleman's Agreement and Zebra Corps. What we find the issue is a lot of our fits are very, very tight, and, you know, most of our pilots do have advanced weapon upgrades 5, for example, you know what I mean? And that's a long train to get that bad boy, you know, but our fits are all so tight and have been honed so to that sweet spot that you need all those fitting skills, and that tends to become more relevant than having XT2, for example.
That's a good point. I mean, there's a Dominic's fit in Noir's UFD, which is how we think about our fleet doctrines. UFD armor Dominic's, designed to hit out to 150 kilometers, has literally zero CPU to spare. You need max everything to be able to fit it. But that's our official fit. And, I mean, it's fantastic for what we use it for. But it is quite demanding on your, not just your weapon skills, because it actually doesn't have any Tech 2 weapons aside from the sentry drones. The high slots are just drone control stuff and newts. But at the same time, you do need like the Tech 2 drone controls, and you need max CPU fitting, because those take up a lot of CPU per unit. So yeah, it's a complicated issue.
I would say to new pilots coming up, you know, where they're looking to invest their SP, you know, if you're unsure about which weapon system you want to go down, you know, and if you're not 100% certain, fool around with the T1 systems for a little bit and invest that time into your fitting skills. It's going to benefit you more in the long term, I would suggest.
Certainly. But at the same time, if you do go to an organization that tells you we need this, this, and this, generally speaking, in terms of EVE culture, it's sort of expected that you'll prioritize what the group needs, because it's not like you're never going to use these skills. I think a lot of players coming in, they're like, oh, well, do I need to train this or do I need to train this? Well, the answer is yes, both. You know, like somebody asked me, should I go for a logistic ship or should I go for a hack? Like, which one of these am I going to use? Like, yes, both of them. Like, are you asking me which one first? Because that's a little different. Like, you are going to use almost every skill that you train, unless you do something completely different, like you start off as a miner, and then you decide you want to become a combat pilot, or vice versa. Yeah, those skills aren't going to overlap. But in terms of combat skills, your core skills are going to carry over. Your ship skills are probably going to carry over. You might not stay with the same corp or alliance that you're in right now. You might switch over, and maybe they'll use some of the skills that you trained before. Maybe they won't. Maybe they'll ask you to train some new ones. Maybe those new ones, once you get them, will open up new doors for you, other places that you can go. So don't feel too bad about mandated training.
Yeah, it is worth thinking about, you know, if you're training for something that's going to be like the flavor of the month, that can end up coming back to bite you a little bit, in that it's like, oh, well, we don't use our Caracal Doctrine anymore because it got nerfed. But you'll still be able to use the skills that you trained there in something else in most cases.
Right, so if the Drake gets nerfed, you know, maybe your Tech 2 Heavy Missiles that you trained up, you're all disappointed about that. But then, you know, maybe the Cerberus gets buffed. Like, that's a thing that happened. The Drake got nerfed, the missiles on the Drake got a bit of a nerf. And then the Cerberus came in, the Serb got a massive buff with the recent hack patch. And the Serb can use heavy missiles. So, you know, these skills do carry over, and especially now with the way that CCP is doing balancing, I would avoid trading for training for flavor of the months, but, you know, don't let it get to you. If this particular patch you feel like your training points were, quote, wasted, end quote, they probably weren't. You know, something will change which opens up new opportunities for the skills you've trained, or the ship that you thought was useless before is going to come back in vogue, like, after a certain patch. You never can tell. You got to take the long view of EVE in everything, and skill training is no exception. Let's get into the EVE news. The big story is AAA and Solar, who were previously mortal enemies, have decided to blew up and form a gigantic pan-Russian bloc, Stainwagon and the Solar. And they are deploying to fight Nulli Secunda and their coalition, which includes Pandemic Legion. And this has been really unexpected. I think it caught a lot of people unawares, but I think everyone involved was sort of preparing for a war in general. I just think everybody thought it was going to be the CFC versus N3, with sort of Stainwagon being a third party, instead of Stainwagon and Solar coming together to fight N3 and CFC being the person on the outside looking in. Quite strange.
Very interesting, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things, like, the announcement came and then hostilities started, like, just like that, overnight, practically. The Russians deployed, like, I think within 24 hours of their being blue, into Amencia, which is the home area of N3. And N3 was like, oh, really? Well, we're going to deploy to your home area. And then they're reinforcing systems in Catch. Both sides are attacking each other offensively. Both sides are defending systems successfully. We've had huge fleet fights, dead supers. Xander,
dead,
what do you
servers.
Think? Yeah, a few servers did pay the price. They gave the ultimate sacrifice.
I think the funniest thing about this is either side's going to admit to this, of course. But AAA have been flying on the same side as CFC.
Yeah, that's sort of true.
I mean, who would have predicted that 12 months ago?
I definitely don't think either side would be like, oh yeah, we're allies of them. But the CFC has come down and helped them out on more than one occasion. Or at least
enemy of my enemy is my friend,
aligned.
You know.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's what it is. Because M3 has explicitly said that the entire purpose of their coalition is to defeat the CFC at some point. So I think
yeah, well played, Pro God. Well played.
It makes sense, sort of.
It's not a good core basis for a block. It really isn't. You know, it's a pretty weak... I mean, I think the reason that we see alliances such as Goonswarm and AAA to a degree as well, actually, that survive for so long is because they have a kind of more fundamental core group mentality than let's get together to kill Goonswarm. That in itself is a kind of flawed fundamental reason to fly together, I would suggest.
I tend to agree with you, however, you sort of see this pattern happen. Like, this isn't the first time a anti-X coalition has popped up. It's just something that tends to happen when the dominant coalition gets to a certain size and position, and then you kind of have this like mentality of, oh, well, we better start banding together, or otherwise they're going to be too big for any group to take on. And I think that's sort of what M3, perhaps plus adding in several personality conflicts and bad blood that have factored into it, but I think that the general, at least public pitch, is that kind of mentality. Like, oh, if we leave CFC unchecked, they already have half of EVE, they're just going to roll over the next group that they target unless we all come together and try to stop the big evil.
Here's the problem with being an anti-Goonswarm block, for example. Either you don't kill Goonswarm, in which case Goonswarm laugh at you, or you succeed, and then what do you do? Because your whole reason right. for existing is now gone.
And then you fight.
Historically, the answer has been turn on each other, or fall apart from internal stagnation. But, you know, not great options if you're a coalition.
Provides a lot of content for the rest of us, though.
It does at that. Speaking of, if you are AAA, Solar, M3, CFC, or any other interested party, Wire is going to be available for contracts in December, and we'd love to hear from you. We've already had a few inquiries on it, but I think with the recent massive capital and super capital losses on all sides, people are a bit tight with the cash. It seems to be.
That does kind
you
of
guys don't charge that much, do you?
Style.
No, we don't charge that much, but it's a weird space, Xander. Like, you're either Pandemic Legion, where it doesn't matter what you charge. Like, you coming into a conflict will be the tipping point, you know? PL or BL. And then there's our level, where we can't, like, single-handedly turn a war. We can, like, shut down all or nearly all NPCing in a particular region. But that may or may not, in their minds, affect the on-field fighting. So it really depends. Certain people see a value in it. I would certainly argue it's quite valuable, especially for the relatively low prices that we charge. But coalitions have to prioritize their SRP. They're prioritizing super caps, like hiring additional players to fight for them. It's sort of the back line is not really a high priority in a lot of coalitions' minds. Not all. We have been hired by AAA in the past several times. We've been hired by groups in Proviblock. We've been hired by groups in CFC. We've been hired by, you know, not necessarily high commands of these places, although AAA did hire us officially once. But usually it's like wealthy individuals within them that want to see their alliance succeed at a particular goal, or they want to get something done and they can't convince their alliance to spare the people to do it, so we get called in to go do it, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I know you guys were involved in morale operations sometimes as well, which is also worth doing.
Yeah, we turned the Providence War from probably a several-month grind to they cracked in, what, 2 weeks? The Providence. So, that was before Allie's time, but
not that I haven't heard about it.
Yeah, well, there was two factors. There was all of CVA's capital ships dying in one fight. That was a big part of it. But then after that, you know, Providence was still putting up fleets. They still had a lot of people active. And we killed off one alliance and reduced NPCing activity to near zero in the other half of it. So much so that AAA pilots were annoyed with their leadership and were complaining because we were, quote, taking their kills. Like, they would roam in, they wouldn't be able to find anything because we'd already been there and killed it. It was good times. But, yeah. So it's definitely something we're watching. We've got Mad Annie, who can allow us to literally watch these fights in glorious detail. He's been doing some great camera work on the large fights that have been going on with the various stations that have been put into reinforced. I don't think we're going to get into, like, which station was reinforced by who and it got saved and this and that, but there have been some extremely memorable battles, and definitely check out twitch.tv/mad_Annie if you want to watch these in real time, or 10% of real time, as the case may be. In smaller fighting news, we had SCL5 this past weekend. And this was extremely exciting, especially for this cast, because both Xander and I were involved in the actual presentation of the event. We were involved as hosts and commentators, and it was an absolute blast.
It was a riot. It was a lot of fun. It's obviously, I've followed SCL closely since its inception, and to be asked to be involved, even though the circumstances from my perspective were a little bit unusual, but I won't dip into that too closely here, but it was very, very nice to be asked, and it was a very exciting, if very, very tiring weekend.
Yeah, it was quite the marathon. We went from about 5-6 hours every day. I think it was about 6 hours the first day, and the second day was easily 7 to 8 hours with all the delays.
Yeah, I mean, I was sat down right about 5 o'clock yesterday, Sunday, and I was there until just about 1:45 in the morning. So it was just short of 8 hours.
So for those listeners not familiar with it, SCL is the Syndicate Competitive League. This was their 5th iteration of the tournament. If you've watched the Alliance Tournament or the New Eden Open, it's kind of like that. Teams come together. Doesn't have to be from the same alliance, but it frequently is. They'll put a team of up to 10 together with limited points, and they field them over a series of matches, and it's pretty interesting. For my part, I found the matches a bit more exciting than the last Alliance tournament. Not every match, certainly. There were a few squashes, but there were more comebacks and more turns, like very pivotal moments that, oh, this is where that fight turned, and then a lot more things that came down to the last couple minutes and that sort of thing. I was just thoroughly, legitimately enjoying the matches.
How did the rules work out to prevent it from being like Dominic's tournament?
There is a ship banning that's sort of allowed. So each team bans one ship and then they all ban another ship.
Well, right. But I mean, people in SCL4 and in the Alliance tournament were still getting their drone setups through the ship ban. I know the SCL5 rules saw the drone ships have increased point values. And I'm just curious how that ended up affecting the teams that people were fielding.
Basically, how they got around about that was by switching out Dominics for Marauders, which appeared in great numbers in most fights in one way or another.
Interesting.
And they also sort of replaced the Dominics with the Eos, which is a drone command ship. We saw a lot of Eoses fielded.
Sorry, some of you listening may not be aware of this, if you aren't up to date on what the SCL is, but all the fights happened on CC, which meant that SCL5 was fighting under Rubicon rules, effectively. So Marauders had Bastion mode, for example. The Stratos was available as a ship and was used, so it's a little bit different to Tranquility in that regard.
Yeah, it was the first on-screen view of what combat's going to look like in Rubicon, and I thought it was pretty exciting. The Marauder models, for the most part, look great. The new Sisters of Eve ships are fantastic looking, and they are extremely combat viable. I mean, the Cruiser one was fielded I think about 3 times, and almost every time it appeared, it held its own, certainly. So I think it's going to be quite a viable ship on the live server, even if it was included in some setups that, in my mind, did not really take advantage of the strength of the ship, which is it has a resist bonus, which goes great with Logi. But oftentimes they were fielded in teams that had no Logi, just because they're a huge pile of DPS, which they are.
I have said it in several different places already before now, but god damn, that Stratios is just a gorgeous looking ship. It's not something I generally care about, but my word, it's a beautiful looking spaceship.
I totally care about the aesthetics of the ships, because, you know, you gotta look at the tail end of it for sometimes hours at a time. Might as well enjoy it.
This is what people say about playing girl characters in WoW.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a joke here somewhere.
But yeah, I mean, it's true. They're definitely a unique appearance for ships in EVE and a very unique coloration. They're much more bright than a lot of the other ships in the game.
Well, they're white. They're like stark white with red highlights and that blue energy thing that goes around the ring.
They're definitely not typical looking EVE ships, I would suggest.
But at the same time, they sort of fit. Like, I talked about this a little in the cast, but they're supposed to be Sisters of EVE faction ships. And, I don't know, it sort of looks like a Sisters of EVE ship. Like, it doesn't look like an explicitly combat vessel. It's painted white, nice, bright, clean lines. You know, the Sisters of EVE are supposed to be, like, the missionaries of EVE. Like, they're the faction above reproach. They're not like a dirty pirate faction, which has to be all aggressive and dark or weird. They're like normal. And I think that they look the part.
Can you be slightly underwhelmed by the animations on Bastion mode?
I thought they looked cool.
In certain ones they look cool, like the Chronos. Looks fantastic. That Bastion mode is amazing.
Yeah, the Chronos does look good.
Paladin I was a little underwhelmed by. The Golem, I think the Bastion mode animation for it is cool looking. I don't like the Raven model in general. I hope they give it the Scorpion treatment at some point. The Vargr
I was unimpressed by. Like, great, the panels move. That's kind of cool, I guess.
Well, here's the thing, it looks cool. The problem I had was that I could not, for the love of me looking at it, tell if it was in Bastion mode or not. Like, having the extra metal on the fins is awesome. Having it move, like, slightly to indicate that it's in Bastion mode is not. Especially whereas with all the other Bastion modes, it gives off this blue glow. You know, you can visually clearly see whether it's in the mode or not. And I did not get that same sense of clear visual indication off the Vargr model, although it does look badass.
This is my problem with triage carriers. I can never tell if a carrier is in triage or not. Oh, I was just going to say, I know it glows yellow, but that's not enough. Anyways, go ahead, Xander.
I was going to say, going back to the tournament setting, I mean, I think... even Fozzie himself said during the stream that he was expecting there to be a lot of Marauder presence. I don't think he was expecting quite as much as there was, and it'll be interesting to see the potential reaction to Marauders for future tournaments, you know, whether it be SCL6, the New Eden Open, for example, you know, whether the points change, how prevalent they're going to be going forward, because they were fairly dominant. There weren't a lot of fights that myself and Alex watched where Marauders didn't play a fairly significant role one way or the other.
I would disagree with you slightly. I think they were present quite a bit. I would disagree that they were dominant. Several times the presence of Marauder did not seem to affect the outcome a great deal. I mean, obviously it's a huge chunk of points and a powerful ship, so the attackers have to plan around it, but...
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I mean, sometimes, some of the fights we're watching, the team that lost really flew the Marauder very, very badly indeed. You know what I mean? But they were very often... whether flown badly or flown well, they were very often the defining decisive factor in any fight.
I think it's sort of like having a logistic ship on your team. Not OP, but it's a signal to your opponent, like, oh, you have to deal with this somehow. You have to fly away from it, you have to neut it down, you have to leave it for last or primary it and get it out of the way, but nowhere in between. But, I mean, there were enough fights that, like, say the Marauder was the last thing standing, and it was just, like, a big chunk of the other team whacking at its tank and not breaking it, and time would run out. Even in the finals, that happened. That I would say that, like, the team that brought the Marauder was the one that won. Like, that definitely wasn't the case.
Yeah. I mean, the ship of the tournament for me, and I'm fairly certain you're going to agree with me on this, was the Vulture. That ship, it was just so impressive the whole weekend. When it was flown properly, it just is the fleet comp just it wouldn't die. They just wouldn't die.
Yep. So a team called Footwork, which we end up placing second, brought this Golem triple Vulture setup, which was, I mean, I was at the analyst desk. I wasn't commentating at the time, but I was like flabbergasted. I could not for the life of me understand how these Vultures were doing what they were doing, but they were fit with railguns and they were absolutely shredding everything on the field. And sure enough, I EFT'd it afterward. They can put out over 600 something DPS at 41 clicks, which in a tournament setting is crazy good. And in the final matches, they were banned, like, for every match. So Footwork couldn't bring it again. But yeah, I think that was definitely the out of nowhere superstar of the tournament. I'd say the other one that bears mentioning is the Slefner. We saw that come in a lot. It sort of brought back the Mimitar Rush team. And I wasn't sure with the recent changes to command ships whether we would see the Slefner play as prominent a role in tournament teams as we had before, because they used to be the absolute core of a Mimitar Rush. But then they lost the turret, you know, there were some changes to its fitting and things like that. But it still looks like they are quite good ships to bring. Anyway, it was cool to see Rubicon, it was cool to see the new ships. Definitely looking forward to the next Alliance tournament and the next SCL, which, oh, by the way, NAR Academy got roped into participating at the very, very last minute because one of the teams dropped out and it was either redo the brackets or get a team to replace. And I was like, you know what? I could probably get a team together in like 12 hours. So sure enough, I found a gullible NAR Academy guy who had been asking for lots of FC experience. He wanted to FC. He's like, okay, guy, here you go. And this just happened to be the second fleet he ever, like, led, and it was the tournament fleet. And he got his ass beat, but he had such a good time, and the rest of his team had such a good time. There's all this chatter on the NAR Academy forums now about doing regular team practices and trying to field an actual full prepared team for the next SCL, and they all seem to have learned a lot and had a lot of fun, so that was really cool to see.
I was gonna say, some of the sound pilots who were really into the Alliance tournament were making noises about, hey, maybe we should talk to Nor and make an SCL team together, so maybe I should get them in contact.
Indeed, maybe we should get them to apply.
That too.
But one of the cool things about SCL as opposed to the Alliance tournament is now we have the new rules in the Alliance tournament this year where you had to be locked into that Alliance. So you couldn't really make, or it's become substantially more difficult to make super teams up or get together with your friends who are perhaps flying within other alliances. Whereas with the SCL, there are no restrictions in that regard. So, you know, if you want to get together, you know, with another Alliance, you know, you perhaps don't have enough pilots yourself and you want to get together with some friends who are flying in a completely different part of New Eden, you know, you can get together and make those teams, you know what I mean? Which it makes it a little bit more pure in that regard. I mean, I completely agree with CCP for changing the Alliance tournament rules the way they've done it, because I do think that the Alliance tournament should be the Alliance tournament, the clue's in the name. But I think it's cool that we have the alternative in the SCL where you can make those super teams up.
The barrier to entry is pretty low. The entrance fee is pretty low. You don't need any prior experience. So if you're out there and you're interested in doing this sort of thing, see if you can get 5 to 10 friends together and go for it. What's the worst that happens? You lose and have a learning experience and you have a lot of fun getting your name out there. You know what I mean? So we should also give the placing. The first place team was Try the Verge. Second place, Footwork. And third place was Dunktown Abbey. Just a fantastic name.
It's just like the best name. I wanted those guys to do well purely on the basis of that amazing name.
Who were they drawing their pilots from?
It looked to me like a bunch of Black Legion guys, but I don't think that was the only place. Probably BL Pizza. I didn't do name checks, but I did recognize some BL pilots from when we were in there. Like my man Ipsimus was in there. Kill McKill. It's good stuff. And they brought what I think, aside from the Vulture team, which is neat, you know, just because it was surprising, I think Dunktown Abbey brought the absolute coolest team, where they completely out-meted Try the Verge and talk, basically with their banning and stuff, sort of forced them into a turret team. And so Try the Verge brought this blaster team that they had brought before, a bunch of Astartes and Deimoses and stuff. And they had armor rep drones to keep their logistics up. But Dunktown completely swerved them and brought 3 Sentinels, 3 Harbinger Navy issues, and like all these control ships, and just neutered, tracking disrupted the hell out of them. And this is with the Sentinel buff. It has a massive range buff to its newts now in Rubicon. And they were just... it was dominant. I think they had a flawless victory on that one. Where they went wrong is they brought that same setup twice in a row, and that wasn't going to work. They got completely trashed. So that was a shame, but they definitely have a place in my heart for best setup. Other events to talk about. There was a CCP live event, which we had the guy that runs live events on SCL, but you know, it would be quite impolite to bring this up considering how controversial it was. But since it's me and Xander and Allie on the CSM here and you guys listening to us, we're going to talk about it. I would think of it as 2 steps forward, 1 step back. They were really ambitious with this live event. There were a couple cool innovations that I think were probably steps forward, and then the actual execution and result of it was a bit of a mess.
This whole topic of conversation is really difficult for me because I think CCP made some mistakes here, but like the live event stuff I think is really, really important. And you know, in being critical of what they did manage to achieve, you don't want to put them off trying it again. You know what I mean? Because you know, a lot of people are into this kind of stuff. It's not my particular kettle of fish, but you know, this stuff's important. It does create content for a lot of players out there, and you know, the lore, the role playing aspects of the game. This is completely supports their avenues of gameplay, and for us to sit here and be critical, you know, and put them off doing it again, you know, it's counterproductive. You know, so it's kind of awkward to talk about it, really.
In the words of that one commercial, I was there. I went to the live event. I am between jobs at the moment, and so was able to show up to something that started at 1 p.m. on a weekday. I would say that I agree with Xander. I was in a Kaldar or Galente Minmatar fleet, and I did not end up actually even seeing the pirate fight. I was in one of the fleets that tried to regroup anticipating gate camps and did not make it there in time. So there were some frustrations. There was some, you know, it was interesting being in a fleet with a bunch of people who hadn't seen time dilation before. I'm reasonably familiar with it, having been in Nullsec. I see 10% tie-dye. I just, you know, start playing Bejeweled in the background while I warp. No big deal. Our comms were very distressed about it, however. But overall, the scale and the ambition was, I think, a good thing for live events. And even if I didn't end up getting it, it made me more interested in the lore and more interested in the sort of roleplay game.
And, you know, I think...
it didn't have that effect for me, but...
I mean, I think there's an awareness. I'm going to be very careful how I word this, but I think there's an awareness from CCP that this event was controversial, to say the least, because we were, myself and Alex, were very, very fortunate to have Etern on the SCL stream, and he was a really fantastic guest. He was very talkative, and we discussed a whole number of things, but we were told beforehand to steer away from the conversation, you know, any discussion of the live event that happened a couple of days before. We were, you know, that was off limits, that form of conversation.
Yeah, and probably for good reason. I mean, it wasn't really germane to the broadcast. And to be honest, okay, we have the opportunity to ask him questions. There's nothing he could really have said that would have added to the, you know, added to the conversation. So I don't disagree with that decision. It allowed us to talk about, you know, other topics a bit more forward-looking, a bit more interesting, that he'd be freer to, you know,
say. I don't know. It's about a little bit elephant in the room, isn't it? Let's not beat around the bush here.
Well, it was, yeah. But as an elephant, like, okay, the elephant's in the room now. What do you do with it? Like, there was no productive way to frame that oven to have the conversation, just to have it and acknowledge it. And I would rather have it on this format, where,
yeah,
you know,
we're not
trying to lead into matches and stuff, and we have more than, say, 4 or 5 minutes to, you know, to talk to somebody, and then we have to, like, talk about match predictions and such.
I mean, the other issue they've got here, and it's something I talked about again in the stream, is the fact that, you know, when they're pulling together these, when CCP are pulling together the whatever assets they need in terms of pilots and in terms of ships, they've got two completely different opposing forces to think about. You know, on one hand, you've got to deal with the fact that there are going to be some 0.0 fleets pulled together, you know, block fleets that are going to be well organized and drilled. They're going to come after you and try and ruin the event. And on the other hand, you have a group of ragtag high seckers who perhaps don't have the same level of fleet experience, and they're getting thrown together in kitchen sink fleets and expected to go and fight that same CCP entity, in whichever way it's formed up. So CCP are trying to balance a force within the game to deal with OP 0.0 block fleets and ragtag kitchen sink relatively inexperienced high sec fleets. And, you know, which way do you try and balance it? You know, I mean, if you go too powerful, then you have what happened on the day where the high sec fleets effectively got whelped. I wasn't there, but my understanding was that the high sec fleets fared very, very badly because the CCP fleets were set up to deal with Goonsworm coming in and ruining them, you know, stomping in the puddle, for example.
It was, wow. I mean, a lot of the high sec people got mad at CCP, like, oh, you're throwing us to the wolves in 0-0. But, I mean, I will say it could have gone better than it did. Like, the way it worked out is a lot of players that hadn't experienced 0-0 got tie-dye and blobbed, which is not really, like, the most rewarding 0-0 experience if it's your first time and you have all these preconceived notions about what life in 0-0 was like. That said, you know, it was a good effort to get players moving outside of their comfort zone, which isn't necessarily a bad thing in an event. I just think CCP needs to be a bit more realistic about what those players are going to be able to do with limited CCP involvement, and perhaps be a bit more hands-on FCing them. They definitely need to cut down the jumping. Like, they started in two systems. Okay, first of all, there were two different live events going on that were connected. That was a good idea. I like that idea because it solved sort of the issue that we had in Asakai, or not Asakai, the Battle of
Kaldari Prime.
Kaldari Prime, sorry. So, Battle of Kaldari Prime. Awesome event. If you could get in. And if you couldn't, you were, you know, kept company by like 600 or 700 other players, which were all orbiting the gate, spamming the jump button to see if they could, you know, catch one person being potted or jumping out and manage to get in and participate. That is obviously not ideal. So having two separate but connected events did help alleviate that somewhat. But tie-dye was a huge issue, like a really huge issue. And yeah, apparently direction from the CCP FC consisted of like go here, warp here, etc. There was no fleet cohesion despite there being an official fleet for people to join. They were just sort of left on their own. And there were some organized groups like RVB, which obviously had their own FC, but you know, the majority of players that were not connected to 0-0, not connected to that, obviously would have no idea that was going on. So they were just sort of left on their own and jumped into bubble camps and got roasted alive. And that was after having jumped like 15 jumps from their form-up system to the event system in 10% tie-dye, which I can vouch is not fun in any way.
I think one of the things that would be a good idea for future events of similar, it would be for CCP to play the role of sort of the block general, the person who to go out and proactively coordinate with people who are interested in forming fleets and help those people form more organized fleets. Because if I had realized that this is something that, you know, there were going to be a whole bunch of people and they were going to need to be a fleet, I would have led a fleet. You know, I'm not great, but I'm better than just some random dude. You know, I would have done that, but I would have needed the same kind of support that you get when you're running an operation in, you know, a larger nullsec conflict, which is to say coordination with other FCs, some idea of the target, some idea of the intel, that kind of thing.
Or if they can't, because they're too busy managing tools, like identify players that can. For instance, Mangala Solaris is a CSM member, an RVB FC, and was leading a fleet on behalf of the Empire. It would have been a pretty simple matter to sort of go, hey, you, join Eve Voice and be the target caller for this mass of 250 noobs that are following us around.
Yep.
But then how much of this, you know, how much are we drilling down to a root issue here of do the live events team within CCP have the resources they require to do this job properly?
I mean, it depends on, I don't think they necessarily need more resources so much as just to use the ones that they have a little better. And that includes players. They have player resources and they could tap those.
I think as soon as you start relying on players to achieve these things, that's opening yourself potentially to all kinds of problems, you know what I mean? Starting metagaming, that kind of stuff, you know what I mean?
It's a player event that involves players. Why shouldn't it involve the players? I mean, if they're calling on the Capsulars for help, certainly the Capsulars can provide that.
I mean, I don't disagree with you, Ali, but the problem is the first time somebody goes and ruins that, you know, the first time somebody's put in a position of authority, you know, a player's FC or something, and he deliberately goes and whelps a fleet or that, then that collapses all in its ear.
Well, then you have the time or the storyline of them being a traitor or something like that. I mean, it's supposed to be player contributions to the larger narrative. You do have to give those players some room. But at the same time, like, you have to go, okay, that could happen, and it could be interesting if it does or doesn't, versus what happened here, which didn't seem to be terribly interesting for anyone. The high-sec people feel like they got smashed. The more organized high-secers decided to stay out of it for the most part. The null-sec guys got tons of kills, but it wasn't really challenging in any way, and frankly, from a few of the null pilots I've heard of, they thought it was rather boring. So, well, there's that, or you can take a risk and look to established or prominent players that have involved themselves in the event and sort of include them temporarily in some kind of role. Or several players, even if it has to be, especially if there are tons of players to keep track of. And again, that's only if someone like a CCP Etern or a CCP Falcon can't get personally involved in organizing the fleet more than they are because they have more stuff to do. I think what Ali said was quite right. There's a resource here, the player resource, and that resource wasn't managed right in general.
I wonder if at all the other resource that they're going to have available to them soon, the Twitch integration into Rubicon, I wonder if that could be used somehow to evolve how live events work going forward.
How do you mean?
Well, you know, if it's a participation issue, if it's getting people involved, if it's an advertising tool, could Twitch integration with the client itself within EVE Online, could that be used by CCP some way to make it a more involving experience?
Well, it's possible. I mean, this Twitch integration could open up quite a few things, or it could not. I think one thing it's going to do is provide like sort of a battle recorder feature, which you know a lot of EVE players have been asking for, and that is, of course, if Twitch remembers to record your broadcast, assholes. Apparently the entire SEL, which we just talked about, was not recorded by Twitch. It was broadcast and not archived. Yeah.
That's awful.
Because they decided to change a default setting somewhere and was never told, like, the person that was running our channel. Okay. Jerks.
Yeah.
Throwing that one out there. Alright, contract wrap-up. Two things to talk about. First of all, wrapping up our 9UI campaign. We were pretty high in the 9UI campaign continuing on the last cast, and we did go forward with a few operations, the most notable of which was killing two Providence CSAAs. That's Capital Ship Assembly Arrays, where Titans and you know, motherships are built. And they were online, and they were not defended. So it was big kills. We think maybe one of them had something in build. We're pretty sure the other one didn't. Either way, just sort of lackluster. We were really hoping Providence would fleet up and fight to defend it.
We did kill a ratting carrier that was trying to rep one of the CSAs. That was really funny.
That's true, yeah. Forgot about that one.
Like, dude did not have a triage module, had one capital shield repper, one capital armor repper, was clearly ratting fit despite being from Providence, and did not get back inside the shield when an enemy fleet hit one jump out. So we landed on him.
Two jumps out. He still didn't get back in. He wasn't even close to back in. He was a good 5-6 kilometers off when we got him.
So we landed and melted him and had a decent laugh over that.
Providence capital ships are an endangered species, so I felt like that was a good kill. But in terms of taking the station again, you know, after taking a few days to recharge, that's when basically all this Russian M3 stuff started up, and that quickly took everybody's attention as Pandemic Legion, Insidious Empire, Ashes, and all those guys would go, oh, this is perhaps a bit more relevant to our strategic interests, and really had to deploy to fight that. And Sound went over to help Brave Newbies and Syndicate. Noir decided to chill, took another contract. We rebuilt our SRP wallet. We had to move some things out of Catch. One of the stations that got attacked was one that we had stuff in. So we had to extract a bunch of ships. We had to wind up protecting a POS. You know, it wasn't like we weren't doing stuff. Our contract was a Hassama POS kill against a corp called Imperium of Man. It was a lab/mineral refinery in a stationless system in Losak Keldari space. And the reason we got hired was because this Imperium of Man corp is apparently quite belligerent to other small corps in the area. And finally one of them got sick of it and said, okay, you're going to screw with me. I'm going to hit you right in the breadbasket. And so they hired us to destroy their most prominent refinery POS. And we did. And we went in, reinforced it, no problems. We came back. There was a scum fleet of frigates that decided to interfere. And we pretty much had a standoff with them because we were in Tier 3 battlecruisers, which cannot track frigates very well. And we were quite far from all of our ships to go get more stuff. So we basically spent a good 2 hours on a Mexican standoff with them until finally they reshipped a few of their guys and went to go attack the tower themselves to get the kill mail, and we managed to work it out so that we wouldn't shoot each other till the tower went down. And that seemed to please both sides. This week in Mercs, Rubicon is coming, and with it come the high-sec Pocos. Everybody is gearing up for this. You're already seeing some prices spike. You're seeing a lot of the alliances that are in the Mercenary Contracts channel get increasing numbers of inquiries about POCO's defenses, attacks, the whole number. Noir, of course, will be no exception. I will be an Empire for the opening of Rubicon doing some stuff. And on the other end of that, which I'm a little bit more excited about personally, is the warp speed changes, hopefully making ratters a lot easier to catch. And I look forward to our first 0-0 contract after Rubicon, where we can put that into practice.
I, for one, cannot wait to see how these changes actually affect day-to-day running around in fleet for myself in 0.0. You know, how you're forced to split fleets, how you're forced to kind of send tackle off by itself. Because at the moment, in 0.0, tackle doesn't generally leave the fleet. You know, you'll have your scouts out in front, but it's now going to become advantageous to keep your tackle separate. You know, it's going to be fascinating to see how it actually plays out in 0.0, you know, when things settle out, exactly what these warp speed changes, how they actually affect how combat works in 0.0.
Yeah, and I noticed when we were on the test server, I finally got a chance to test it out during the SCL weekend, and it wasn't quite as dramatic as I hoped. The deceleration changes that were put in response to a few problems with the massive warp speed increase, like ships were warping so fast that apparently the server couldn't keep up with it, and they were appearing on the grid able to lock stuff before they would say show up on your overview and things like that, which is quite problematic. But it seems like the solution to fix that may have diluted the more revolutionary aspects of this and potentially added a bunch more clicking to the process of combat when you're fighting people that are landing on the grid or when you're warping onto the grid. So hopefully, I'm still held out hope that this will somehow be fixed or trimmed or made a bit more user-friendly by CCP Fozzy, but either way, I think it's still going to be quite the improvement, and I am looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's you can still warp your tackle with the fleet. If you do a fleet warp, they will all warp at the same speed. They'll all accelerate and decelerate at the same speed, and that'll be the speed of the slowest ship in your fleet. But as now you can maybe actually get something by your tackle arriving on grid long before you do, because your tackle might actually catch the guys you're trying to kill.
No, I was aware that if you're fleet warping, your tackle will go at the speed of the slow ship. I knew that, but obviously it's incredibly tactically disadvantageous to do that when you've got that speed advantage. So,
well, I mean, depends. If you're not going to show up, you know, if you're making some warps and you're not going to show up for 20 seconds and the enemy fleet has a lot of anti-support, I could see them taking your tackle out and just moonwalking out.
But it's a new tactical decision for you to make. Do you send your tackle ahead? Do you put them in more jeopardy so you could try to get more kills? Or do you keep everybody together and play conservatively? And I like that option. I like that tactical option. And if you're the defending player getting warped in on, you can decide to stay and engage the tackle and get a couple quick kills and risk being landed on by their big stuff. Or, you know, warping off ahead of the rest of their fleet, and maybe you get caught, maybe you don't. And if you do warp off, do the tackle see where you warped, and then warp there themselves, landing ahead of you because they're way faster.
Even if the tackle do that, you can kind of kite them, because if you're in something reasonably small and fast, say you warp at a similar speed to the tackle, so the tackle chases you, you let them see where you warp off to, they warp off again. Now their fleet is mid the first warp, you're landing after the second, tackle lands with you, you blow them up, you've now got a lot more time before the big stuff shows up, potentially.
Yep, it's going to be really interesting for solo PvPers like, you know, like Garmin and those type of guys who do that warping around stuff to split fleets up. They're going to have an easier time doing it, but on the other hand, if they are trying to legitimately run away from that small tackle, they're going to have a harder time escaping. So it's definitely going to have some interesting impacts. I think all told, it's much more exciting way to look at PvP and movement. And I'm pretty pumped. I can't wait to take out like an armor hack fleet with this new change and have it roam around super fast.
It's relatively super fast, yeah.
Well, at the moment, they can potentially be outrun by a battleship at some times. So now at least they will warp faster than battleships, battle cruisers. And it's not just about the align speed anymore.
Yeah. I may be in your armor hack fleet.
Speaking of, yeah, Allie, you have a rather big announcement.
So when I started playing, when I started co-hosting Declarations of War, Alex was asking CSM8 for anyone who was interested in podcasting. He was saying, you know, it's a little bit of a big deal. We haven't really had a non-war co-host before. So, you know, we're trying you out, see how that works. Well, about that, I'm going to the dark side. I'm selling my spaceship for cold hard cash and joining Noir Mercenary Group in the search of that elusive fun, which I've heard can be found in EVE Online. So I should be moved over, and then I'm gonna have to learn all sorts of new things. I'm training a Tech 2 weapon system so that I can fly one of your Doctrine ships. But while that goes in, I'll probably be providing logistics or whatever. Looking forward to it. Should be very interesting. It's a completely new direction for me. I've been in the same corp since I resubscribed. We've sort of been tootling around in 00, and haven't been as mobile as a mercenary group is, so we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, and having worked with you on the podcast and talked with you about CSM stuff and flown with you during the contract that you hired us for, and with this whole thing in on UI, I can say that, you know, Nora's going to welcome you with open arms. I think you're extremely well liked within the guys. I like you. I think you're an extremely good player with, you know, a real love for the game and a passion for it. And I have a feeling you're going to find Noir to be a pretty good place for players like that.
If you guys wanted me to go and, you know, grab a cup of tea while you guys have your little loving, you know what I mean? I'll just go and leave you guys to it for 5 minutes if you want, you know? And get all romantic down here.
That's all right, Xander. You can podcast it. I know CC needs content.
You're the best.
I was going to say that sounds like a Xander and Poetic Stanzel episode.
Oh, wow. Ooh. Boom. Burn.
See, we're rubbing off on her already.
There's another joke we will go down.
Phrasing. All right, so welcome, Ali Ras, and the other sound pilot is Rethel?
Yeah, not sure if he's coming over. We talked about it. I don't know. I have to talk to him again.
All right, well, we welcome you with open arms. It'll be a blast, especially with Rubicon coming up. We are going to be extremely busy.
I cannot wait to shoot high-sec Pocos. That sounds like the best. Shooting structures, oh man. At least I get paid for it, though. That's the improvement.
Like, yeah, exactly.
It's not just sit around.
Get that mad cash. You can watch But I'm Chris Jericho while you're doing it as well. Nothing better. All right, we have no user submitted stories for this week in Mercs. Feel free to send us stuff, either on the comments or by emailing Alexei of Card. We're quite happy to talk about other mercenary groups. If you would like to send us your specific story, you know, instead of just talking about like general trends in the mercenary world, we're happy to focus on specific contracts, events, corporate and alliance developments. Reach out to us, and we are happy to feature you. Okay, so CSM Roundup. We're quite happy to have Xander here with us. He's extremely focused on CSM issues, perhaps most famous for his comprehensive interviewing of all the candidates for the last CSM election, which was quite a massive undertaking and very impressive execution. Do you say so myself?
Thank you very much. Very kind of you to say so.
So, being so aware of the CSM and sort of the challenges and issues that they face, you know, the failings and successes of past CSM, so on and so forth, how are you viewing the current CSM term?
Wow, that's a really horrible question to ask me in front of Ali, isn't it? That's a really... So I've got a prominent member of CSM 7 asking
Xander,
the question.
Xander, great question or the greatest question?
The greatest question.
All right. So whatever you can say, I've heard worse on the forums already. Just keep that in mind.
So you know, it's difficult for me because obviously I've not had that. I mean, it's such a loaded question, Alex, because you've done it. You've done the job, but I've not. I think CSME have done an excellent job so far. I think there are still some issues with how CCP utilize CSM and communicate with the CSM. But I think CSME as a whole have done a very good job so far. I think the major criticism that fairly or otherwise was leveled at CSM7 was one of communication. I don't think CSME have got that perfect yet by any stretch of the imagination. I think they've got it significantly better than 7. I think a lot of the reason that that was lacking in 7 was an overall lack of participants, active participants taking part in the process, and people that had been elected and then just went radio silent. The impression I get from speaking to CSME is a much, much larger percentage, although not 100%, it should be pointed out, but a much larger percentage of CSME appear to be active, and communication seems to be better. I would say that they didn't handle this RMT situation as I would have liked. I'm probably biased in that regard, though. I don't think that the communication they gave from that was perfect. But overall, a very strong performance so far. I do think, as I said earlier, I do think that there is a very serious issue with how CCP utilises the CSM. I still don't think that they're getting the most out of the body as a company overall, but that's not CSM8's fault as such. It sounds like they're doing everything they can to push to make that communication better. But I think there's probably still some fundamental issues within CCP that's stopping that from happening. So yeah, overall, good so far.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with the fundamental issues thing. And one of the overarching themes of the CSM is that it's a, from CCP's point of view, the point of view of CCP staff, aside from some basic, at like a very basic level, yes, there are people you must deal with, but in terms of like involving them in features and going out and doing anything more than like a last minute feedback kind of thing, there's really no obligation from the average CCP employee to engage with the CSM. A lot of the CCP employees that have chosen to do so, I think, have been feel very positively about the experience of having done so and continue to do it. But there's no like checklist in the process, like, oh, if you're working on this and then this, you have to talk to the CSM on this level of thing and this level of thing and this level of thing and this level of thing. We've been trying to get it to that point. I say we as a former member, and you know, I assume CSM8, especially with Robert at the head, is taking a similar track. He likes to get the most information possible. But there's a lot of resistance still from certain parts of the company to giving that information and then hearing what the CSM has to say about said information. But I will say it's at the end of CSM7, it was leaps and bounds better than it had been. And
I don't think it could have been much worse than the first half of CSM7, could it really?
Well, no.
Could have been CSM5.
Could have been CSM5 or CSM4, for that matter. But it was damn close.
The only way was up after the winter summit for CSM7, really, wasn't it?
Oh, me and Allie were just talking about that before the show. Yeah, that was something else. But it was a dark point that I think everybody got past, and I think that the CSM relationship with CCP was at a good point when we left it, and as far as I can tell from CSM8, they've really taken the baton and run with it very hard, Usain Bolt style.
I was going to say we've, you know, taken it and we've partied on it and trashed into the ground, but that would be a lie and a poor joke. We did some pitching to people who we aren't currently as strongly involved with at the summit. Trevor was the first one to put that in elevator pitch form. but it, you know, it was, it's still a process we've done. I think we've done a lot. I really appreciated where we were coming off of CSM7's term. I feel like you guys did some of the hard work for us. And so now we can just run with that. And we have, we've mostly done so. CCP Dolan's been doing a good job of helping us out there. But it's an interesting process. I hope that we leave. I hope that the CSM process ends up being one of those things where each CSM leaves the relationship in a better place than they found it.
I think that would be a good tradition to uphold after the pretty much clean slate we got after six. Or as clean as possible, considering.
Yeah.
Xander, you mentioned that communication's been stronger, but not quite where you would have liked. You did mention RMT, which you can get into as a topic, but also some. Let's talk structurally. What are they not doing that you would like to see? Where do you think they're falling short?
Well, the lion's share of the communication that we're getting from CSM is coming from two sources that I can see. One is Riparteg, who is providing weekly updates and doing an absolutely sterling job with those. I think they're a fascinating read each week and invaluable as somebody who's interested in the process, finding out what the CSM are doing on a kind of week-to-week basis. And the other person is, without, you know, trying to sound too much of a kiss-ass here, it's Ali herself. You know, she's doing weekly Google Hangouts on Google Plus.
Would you like me to go get a coffee and leave you two alone?
Oh, wow.
It's actually, Xander, it's actually every other week now. I was not able to keep every week up with, like, strong content, and since moving to every other week, I think we've had a more productive discussion without having to dig into, like, let's all talk about what we made for dinner tonight or whatever.
Yeah, and that's cool. I mean, it's one of those things that it's going to be refined over time, but I think most of them, to get to the point, most of the communication has been from Ali and Rippard. There hasn't been a whole heap of great blog posts from other CSM members, I would suggest. I also think that the web, and this is a slight criticism towards Ali or the group as a whole, I thought that the idea of having the CSM 8 website was fantastic, and that seems like a grossly underutilized tool. It's something that's been kind of thrown together quickly and not been fleshed out as well as it could have been.
I guess step up on that. What would you like to see there?
You know, I would like to see everybody posting once a week on there. I don't think that's an unrealistic expectation. It doesn't need to be anywhere near the length of what Rippard's doing each week, but I would like to see 50 words a week from each CSM member, and unless you've got a family emergency, you know what I mean? I don't think it's unrealistic to expect, you know, literally the length of a couple of tweets worth of text on there each week from each CSM member just saying, I'm involved in this at the moment, really enjoying it, looking forward to this, you know, X, Y, Z. It doesn't need to be extensive, but I think there needs to be a combined source of, and you know, if it's cross-posted from somewhere else, that's fine,
right.
You know what I mean? But I think it would be good to have a weekly few words from every CSM member, and I really don't think that's an unrealistic expectation. I don't think it's literally going to take somebody 10 minutes to do, realistically. You know, each CSM member 10 minutes to do once a week. As a baseline expectation, I don't think that's unrealistic. And if you've not done anything and you can justify that, that's absolutely fine. You know, I mean, there are going to be some times during the summer where you guys are going to be quiet because, you know, a lot of guys are missing from CCP and Reykjavik or wherever, you know, and that's fine, but put that down there.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is I was trying to do weekly updates for a while and I stopped because I realized I was just posting the exact same thing as Rippard. Sometimes, like, I mean, I would be posting something slightly different. I'd focus on a different part of a particular feature or whatever, but it ends up just being, you know, all of us did the same thing this week. We all went to a stakeholder meeting.
But for one, not everybody reads Rippard's blog. For two, Rippard, I really like Rippard's writing style, but he does write long, detailed posts, which aren't very quickly scannable. And he writes in a very specific voice. I personally think Rippard's a fantastic writer. I think he's probably the best Eve writer out there, personally. But he has a very specific voice, and he writes in a very specific way. And, you know, it would be nice to hear other voices from CSM 8 other than Rippard and Ali Aris.
Makes sense.
And that's not to suggest for one second that I don't believe that other members of CSMA aren't doing good work. I'm talking purely about communication, outward communication here to the player base. You know, guys like Trevor I know are working very, very well, but you know, the major issue with CSM7 in my opinion was this outward communication to the player base. It's definitely better with CSMA. I don't think we're all the way there yet, personally.
It's quite interesting, because one of the complaints that CSM7 heard quite frequently is that we had communication from too many people in too many places, and there wasn't a centralized voice to go find out about things.
It certainly wasn't me that was saying that. I can't speak for anybody else.
You had myself. A lot of first of all, yeah, you were quite right about not having a lot of active people. So you had Celine, Trevor, myself, Hans, and Two Step be really active on forums and podcasts and Twitter quite a bit. And people be like, oh, the CSM's so quiet, so quiet, so quiet. Well, aside from like Elise and maybe one other person, like that was the CSM for CSM7. Now you have a lot more active people, and they've somewhat centralized their communication a bit, but it's never going to be quite right, is it? It's just one of those things. There's such a large and diverse community for the CSM to service in terms of giving them information that everybody's, like you said, not everybody reads Rippard's blog. If you did stuff on Twitter, not everybody's on Twitter. If you did stuff on the e-forums, not everybody reads the e-forums. If you try to do everything and please everyone, you wind up, as Ali said, doing so much double work that you're either wasting your voice just constantly reposting things, or simply burning out. You know, with everybody basically talking and talking in sort of the same places, and even with Hans collecting everything and putting it on the Evo forums, people were still complaining they couldn't find where the CSM was talking or that people were too quiet. And now you've got tons of people working and fewer places to, fewer but more reliable places to hear them in terms of Rippard's blog and this podcast and Ali's hangouts. But it's still like that line still hasn't been found of what's just right. And I think it's going to be quite a challenge because the Eve community is so diverse. Not everybody reads the forums, not everybody's on Twitter, not everybody reads blogs in general, let alone one specific blog, not everybody's into podcasts.
Yeah.
But
if you try
to
do everything, you burn out.
But I think CSM8 found the solution. I really do think this having a centralized website that links to everybody's blog, that links to everybody's Twitter, that, you know, that keeps
and
you up to date
on
whatever
reason. Website.
I think that's the solution. Yeah, but I mean, if I'm trying to advocate, if I'm trying to tell people, right, if you're interested in CSM8, where do you go to? Well, there's this guy's blog, there's this guy's Twitter. You might want to go and look at this guy's posts in the forums. You know, I mean, if there's one place you can send them, right, here's a URL, go there. Everything you need to know, all the details you need to know, their latest postings, their Twitter, their email address, you know, it's all on this one website you can go to. Then it makes it much easier for me as an advocate of the CSM to say, right, go and get involved. Here's the website to go to. Now, there may be technical issues there, obviously. I'm not IT particularly capable in the slightest, so it might be that it's just purely a technical issue that it's too difficult to pull all this into one website. But somebody within CSM8 has obviously felt that it was doable and they've started it, but they just haven't followed through, or certainly that's how it appears from my perspective.
Well, noted.
Yeah, that's something that they're going to work at. I'm sure CSM9 will also have their own particular take of communication. And we'll see what works for how many people. And maybe it is the website. I'm not personally 100% convinced that even that would be enough. But it's certainly a good idea to have one, even just as a resource that the CSM can point to and just say, oh, go here, subscribe to this for regular updates to everything.
And to be absolutely crystal clear, without, you know, I don't just want to sound like a negative Nancy about all this stuff. I do think CSM8 have done a fantastic job communicating with the player base relative to previous CSMs. And I do think it's we're on a much more improved and better level than we were previously. Absolutely.
All right, so here's a question for you. One of the things that I've noticed since becoming a member of CSM8 is that I feel like for the people who are listening, but it's becoming increasingly obvious to me that even when I post something, I wrote recently an article and posted it on themitani.com about the ship maintenance array loot drop fix. SMAs now drop loot. They didn't take an out to fix an exploit. And I wrote an article about the process that the CSM went through to take the issue and put it higher up on CCP's priority list. We went from, you know, it was one of the things that they had on their, you know, back burner to it's something that's fixed and coming out with Rubicon. Dolan was generous enough to basically just let me write what I wanted. So I wrote it. I was very excited sort of from the inside for everyone who wants to read about it. And I discovered that not that many people wanted to read about it. Even when I was writing about something that was, you know, very content rich, not, oh, well, I can't talk about this, I can't talk about that. It didn't get as much attention as some of my other pieces have. And I guess that's the backstory. The question for you is, how would you increase awareness in and interest in the CSM process? Or is this just going to be one of those things like local government that the people who care and the people who don't just don't?
Well, no. Well, first things first, that article was a fantastic piece of writing, Ali. I'm not just saying that to blow sunshine up your derriere. It was a great piece of writing. It was a fantastic insight to how the CSM works practically in terms of a process. It was a great piece of writing. There is, at the moment, a limited number of people who are interested in the CSM as a process, unfortunately. And you, obviously, that article, I'm sure, will have appealed to a large number of those. I don't for one second believe that there isn't a percentage of the people who did end up reading that article who perhaps haven't become more engaged with the CSM as a result of it, Ali. It was a great piece of writing, and while that number might be small, articles like that are what increases the awareness of what the CSM does and what it's capable of doing. And, you know, it might be incremental gains here. You know what I mean? It might be something that just takes time and needs more articles like that to achieve. You know what I mean? But more people are going to read about what AAA are doing with Solar down in Catch than are probably going to read about a fantastic piece on CSM8 process. You just have to, in my opinion, you know, if you just give up and just say, well, nobody's going to read it, you know, nobody's going to read it as much as read about some pause fight that happened in Vail, then you've lost before you even get started. You have to accept the fact that you're going to be chipping away at it, and you're hopefully going to increase awareness little by little, step by step.
Yeah, it's quite a long slog considering how few players are really involved in even the CSM elections. But that, then again, like Xander said, it's something you have to chip away at. You've almost got to accept that it's a long road and then walk it anyway.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, I'm doing that because I'm a part of, I'm on the CSM, and I'm still posting, I'm still doing the communication stuff that I'm doing. I'm just wondering if there's anything like in particular that I could be doing or CSM8 could be doing to help, I guess, move that slog along.
Yeah, well, I don't really think the onus in this one should be as much on the CSM. Obviously, part of your time is going to be involved in raising the awareness of what the CSM does as a body, but the onus on this should be with CCP. And I think that the way they handled promotion of the CSMA election was disappointing, to say the least. I know that they tried to rally to some degree at FanFest. I know that certain individuals within CCP, their hands were tied to a degree for whatever reason within the company itself. But I think that CCP should be doing a better job of promoting what the CSM does. And I think they're getting better, but I think they should be getting better quicker, personally.
Yeah, well, we're certainly going to have a lot to talk about when the actual elections come about. It's going to be a thing. But in the meantime, those minutes, Allie.
I don't know what to tell you.
Where is the process right now?
It's bad. It's bad that we don't have these minutes by now. For whoever's fault it is, it's bad that we don't have these minutes by now.
We're most communicative CSM ever, ladies and gentlemen.
There are Christmas adverts on the television, literally.
Yeah, what I said 2 weeks ago still stands. We've got all the minutes in right now. Dolan's been busy, and he's now, he's told us he's working on them. It's, I think there's something to be said about, like, what the best kind of thing for the minutes is. Because I certainly felt like, I worked on the minutes. Even if the minutes came out tomorrow, I think they would be less interesting and less useful to the community than the PAWS article I wrote. It's the kind of wonky details of CSMA Summer Summit and what we talked about. So you can at least point at things and you can say, we can point at Rubicon features and we can say, yes, we talked about this at the summit. And like with the, so we can say, yes, we talked about this at the summit. But anything that there's in general, not a lot of revelations that come out of the minutes. I think the CSM 7 Winter Summit was a little bit of an exception in that regard. And so I guess what, to turn this from sort of my idle musings into a question, what do you get out of minutes as minutes readers?
See,
particularly Xander.
You're almost trying to justify the minutes not being out by, well, there's not really that much interest in them anyway, and that's
I'm not trying to justify it at all. I'm trying to ask. I'm trying to ask what if they're not out, so something isn't working. I'm trying to figure out what need is being met by the minutes, so I can figure out how to meet that better.
This goes back to what we were talking about previously. If you want people to be invested in the CSM as a process, we need to have documented, clear evidence of how the CSM helps improve the game. And it's great that we have your Hangouts, and it's great that we have Rippard's blog posts, but the official documentation we get as a player base on what the CSM and CCP work together to achieve, apart from the odd dev blog in that, absolutely we get dev blogs in that, but the official documentation we get are the minutes from the two summits. That's what we get. And we're less than 3 weeks from opening our advent calendars, and we don't have the summer summit minutes yet. I mean, it's almost farcical to say that.
I mean, I understand. We're like, what, 1 to 2 months away from the winter summit?
Yeah, I mean, we're super close, and I understand that there have been fairly serious issues that have diverted individuals' time from both within CSM and CCP. But, It's the 12th of November. We don't have the Summer Summit minutes. I mean, it's... I know what you're saying, Ali, that sometimes perhaps we don't get the information from the minutes that we as a player base would hope for, but let us be the judge of that. Give us the minutes and let's have an open and frank discussion
sure.
when we have the minutes on the table. You know what I mean?
Right. So here's what I'm asking. I'm not asking, do you want the minutes? I'm asking, what is the best way to get you the things that you're getting out of the minutes? Like, I could see, like, is there something better that we could be doing? I mean, obviously, having this large document that takes a while to get out, even under good conditions, it takes a while to get out, is challenging.
Okay, so I mean, should the format of the minutes change? Absolutely.
Yeah,
were the winter summer minutes too long? Absolutely. I understand why they chose to do it the way they did it, and it was nice to have such comprehensive minutes. But if that's becoming a detriment to the overall goal of us as a player base, understanding how you guys communicate with each other and what actually goes on at these summits, then you know the format perhaps needs worked on.
Right. I mean, I can write up. You know, I can write up things in a paragraph about, you know, this is what happened this session. We've got some of those already done. I know James Argent in particular has been working on summarizing long minutes into shorter minutes for people who just want to skim them.
So maybe a better way of doing it, I mean, I'm completely spitballing here, but perhaps a better way to do it, if you're asking me here on the fly, would be to have 500 words in each session, literally tops, 400 words. Mm-hmm. And then each session has a thread in the forums. And then you can ask a question and somebody from CSM or CCP will come back to you and say, well, we can't really talk about that, or here's what we can talk about. And, you know, you can have some ongoing conversation within the forums. Maybe the forums aren't the best place to have it. Maybe it's in some blog comments somewhere. Maybe you streamline the minutes and allow the conversation to evolve organically in a set place somewhere else.
Well, I've got a bit of an issue with that, Xander. I like the idea of having a conversation about the minutes, obviously, but having that be a replacement for minutes detail, I think is an issue because, as you said, this is the documented official way that the CSM can show players they're doing. And so now, instead of pointing them to a PDF, you point them to a how many pages long forum thread for them to find out everything that's going on. I think that's a step back.
Okay, perhaps I'm wrong there, but if the current system's not working, then we need to try and figure out an alternative. You know, if it's down to the longevity of the minutes, you know, if it's down to trying to transcribe these long technical sessions, get them on paper, then somebody has to decide what's NDA'd, what's not, then it has to go back to CCP to say, right, we can publish these now, you know, and this process is a process that's taken 4 months to do, then something's going wrong in the process. So, you know, the only way I can see to get the minutes out quicker and to make this whole process better is to streamline the minutes, is to give less detail in those minutes.
So from my perspective, having done it, and I don't know if this exactly matches the experience that Allie's having right now, but from our end, you know, we had less than half of the CSM active, and not everyone was able to do, you know, as many sessions as anyone else. But, you know, whether it was through heroic efforts of Trevor, Two-Step, or however it got done, it got done. We managed to transcribe everything. Not transcribe, but we managed to write up the minutes. It was a Herculean effort. It did take a bit, but it didn't take more than like a month or so, and that was with Christmas being involved. The massive delay came in after giving those sessions over to CCP and then getting them back and getting them cleared. And
that's been the delay in CSM8 as well. I know there were a couple of minutes that were sort of like on the back burner for a couple CSMs, and that includes me. I had the Valkyrie minutes that I was sitting on for a little bit. But we had 90% of the minutes done, and we were prepared to release 90% of the minutes. The minute we had a majority of minutes, we were planning to release them.
So then this rolls back to my question from a while back there about where the CSM sits in the CCP's order of priorities, or how important it is to them. You know, you would think that if the impression I get is that there are a lot. I mean, you'll know better than myself, Ali. Maybe I'm a fairly kind of vocal minority here, but the impression I get is that there's a lot of people asking for these minutes. There's a lot of people interested in where they are and why we haven't seen them yet, and the resources within CCP aren't available to process them for whatever reason. So the question then becomes,
I mean, the resources of CCP Dolan, he's been busy with a bunch of stuff that's also been hugely important. I mean, and he's one of the people who, you know, the CSM obviously talks to quite frequently.
We don't doubt that CCP is not putting good work in within CCP, and we don't doubt for a second that he's not doing work and therefore he can't do these minutes. So then somebody else should be doing the minutes, perhaps, or something, you know. There's a corporate issue here, potentially.
Right. I mean, that's the kind of question that we then go and sit down and talk with CCP. But before I do that, I want to have, like, an idea of what, you know, because if I said, well, the point of the minutes is to, I think there are some people who think, well, the point of the minutes is to, like, tell us about features. That, I think, is better done in dev blogs. And that if the minutes are telling you about a feature, something has gone wrong. And I think Alexei Card would agree with me there.
Yes, a certain M word comes to mind.
Yeah, exactly.
Rhymes with mosses.
Yeah. So if that's how you're finding out about things, that's a problem. And that's a bigger CCP problem. So the question
In terms of the minutes themselves, if I had to do anything to streamline the minutes process, I think probably the best thing that could be done would be to change CCP's review process. During CSM7, the way it worked was you'd do the minutes up, and then everyone at the meeting, or at least the featured people at those meetings, like the people that were brought in, the team heads, for instance, or a certain executive producer or something like that, would have to then look over and approve the minutes. Basically, if they appeared in the meeting, they would check it to see if they felt the content was represented appreciably. And that basically put the meeting minutes at the mercy of literally everyone's schedule at CCP, which, you know, for the Dust guys, if we had waited for Dust to put our minutes out, we would have been waiting 3-4 months on top of the actual blaze to the minutes, which people already were not happy with, despite short form minutes being put out literally days after the summit by Celine, and with our minutes being a combination of the most detailed and most prompt the CSM had done yet. It still wasn't really good enough.
You put out short form minutes and those weren't good enough.
People were not pleased with them. Or at least they were not pleased enough that we didn't get tons of shit for how long the actual minutes were taking, which was a fraction of the time that this round is taking.
Because that was going to be, I mean, that was going to be my first idea, is, all right, we'll just put out the short form ones and, you know, no big deal.
Yeah, I mean, it might be a good idea to do anyway, but it didn't seem to make anyone terribly happy. It was good content in my view, but the people that were asking for the minutes were still asking for the minutes. So what I would do is I would say, okay, rather than have this minute session passed around of the 3 or 4 people from CCP that were brought in to attend, have Dolan or someone that Dolan designates that will have the time to do it just sit down and look. Is this NDA? Is this NDA? Is this NDA? Is this questionable? Let me just, like, lean over and go to the cubicle of the guy or give them a call and be like, hey, the CSM mentions this exact phrase, this all right or this not all right, rather than have a stack of papers on their desk for that person to ignore. I would think if you did that, it might be a bit of work for that person, but probably less work than Dolan constantly having to go back and forth shuttling between people. It would just be less frustrating, I think, overall.
For sure.
So, that's my 2 cents. I definitely hope that the minutes do come out soon and that there are some structural reforms taken to speed up the process for future CSM, certainly. I mean, like I mentioned, we're about to have the Winter Summit relatively soon. And can you imagine if they're still not out by then? You know, then you have two sets of minutes to do. Like, that's not helpful either. It's not like this job is going away. Right,
you know,
on.
I definitely think there's further conversation needed on how the minutes as a document works going forward, absolutely. But that doesn't solve the issue of the here and now, which is the 12th of November and those summer summit minutes for CSM 8, you know.
Moving on, Allie wanted to talk a little bit about the Rapid Light Missile Launcher and Rapid Heavy Missile Launcher changes. So let's talk about that quickly, and then let's get on to the last segment of the podcast, because I know Xander's probably quite tired at this point.
A little bit.
Basically, I just wanted to ask you, and I'd ask Turtle here, but he's gone, what you thought of the whole idea of having a high burst but relatively low DPS weapon system. So for people who are listening and who haven't been following along in the forums, rapid light missile launchers are being changed and the new rapid heavy ones so that they do a great deal of damage over about 40 or 50 seconds. And then they have a 40 second reload time in order to do any damage again. So what you end up with is a sustained DPS number that's lower than their current DPS. Which is the idea. Their current DPS is a little bit unbalanced. But a burst DPS number that is comparable with or better than... comparable with the actual on-size missile system. So you've got rapid lights that are doing as much DPS as heavies or hams, and rapid heavies that are doing certainly cruise DPS.
So to be clear here, sorry, I'm going to ask a dumb question. What we're effectively looking at is something that's kind of almost halfway between a continual flat DPS and a volley. It's kind of like a halfway house between the two almost.
Yeah, it's sort of like a 50-second volley. And obviously you're using missiles that are one size smaller than your normal ones, so the rapid lights have great application against frigate targets who are intended to be the people that you're actually killing them with. It's an anti-support kind of thing. I find it fascinating. I'm excited and looking forward to what happens there. Was curious what you thought, Alex.
So far, the feedback from other PvPers has been positive. I have not had any personal experience with them. Conceptually, I'm sort of nervous about it, because I rather like rapid lights in Fleet Doctrines, and I have a feeling the long reload timer might marginalize that quite a bit. It will certainly require some specialized target calling tactics, which are going to be a little inaccessible for new players. That said, you know, having the long reload time type thing worked out great for ASBs, and I can see why CCP is experimenting with it, and it may work out great. I'm a little skeptical in terms of the practical applications of how it's going to work. It might just be that this is now a solo player's tool or something like that, which would be a shame because we won't be able to use rapid light missile serbs anymore, but you know, might be good for the game overall.
Yeah, I'm interested in it as sort of like a support headshot maneuver, because you've got some support ships that SIG tank, in particular like Guardians or whoever. And it might be interesting to see if you can use these systems to take them out.
That's if they've got the DPS to break them. And that's really what it's all going to come down to. Will the actual DPS number be enough to straight kill those ships, either before reps get there or under reps? And if they can't do that, then the weapon system's going to become irrelevant to large fleet PvP because, you know, 10 seconds for your fleet to reload is already a pain in the ass. If they can, then that might be cool. You kill like one or two logistic ships every minute. That could be cool.
Even if you just get one logistic ship down at the start of a fight, that's still possibly going to switch the fight in your favor, especially for like cap chain logistics.
The number of missile ships you would need, even with these DPS numbers, to kill a like heavily tanked Guardian would mean a comparable fleet size on the other side, where one Guardian probably is not going to make a game-changing difference. But if it's one guardian every minute over the course of 5 minutes, that could be pretty significant.
For sure.
I don't know. Like I said, I'm willing to give it a chance and see what happens. I just have a feeling it may not fit for my playstyle in particular.
Yeah, the one thing I am excited about, I think Rise put this in the thread, is he's talking about going back to them in 1.1 regardless of how they work out. So it's definitely not the case that this is, you know, the final word from CCP on this particular weapon system.
All right. And quickly, Allie, plug the town hall and then we'll move on.
Yeah. Last thing for the CSM segment, our town hall is this Saturday, November 16th at 1900 EVE time. We will be doing it, as usual, on EVE Radio. It's held on EVE Uni Mumble. There's an in-game channel. We're doing a sort of split question system this time. I'm taking questions beforehand. We'll spend the first 45 minutes answering those questions. Because I want to have a chance to curate questions and make sure that the questions that we receive are ones that we can answer in ways that are good. Last town hall, we spent a reasonable amount of time telling people that their question was better suited to the features and ideas discussion subforum. If that's the case, then I won't be answering that question. I can just post in the thread. But yeah, if you email me, Ali Aris, or post in the announcement thread, which we can link in the show notes, you can post there, you can ask a question, it'll be answered on air, we'll have enough time to think about it and give you a real good quality answer. The second half, the remaining 45 minutes, will be spent taking questions in real time. No guarantees there for quality.
Alrighty, and finally, at the request of our fans, we are going to have a masterclass segment, first in a series of fan-suggested segments, and this one is active versus passive tanking, and when it's appropriate to do, and why active tanking doesn't play a role in larger fights. So, for people who are completely new to the two concepts, we'll go over them really quickly, and then we'll go into the details. Active tanking means you've fitted an armor repairer or a shield booster to your ship, and when you start taking fire, you then activate this module, and it potentially consumes charges or capacitor or both, and then it brings back a certain portion of your shields or a certain portion of your armor. And of course you can fit rigs and implants and stuff that give you more rep or faster rep or less cap use, so on and so forth, but that's the basic idea. Now, to fit these things to your ship, typically you will fit these instead of the items that you would use for passive tanking, because passive tanking relies on increasing the total amount of hit points on your ship, but gives you really no way to bring them back. So you could have like a shield extender, which gives you an extra 700 shields or whatever they give you. Or you can have the shield booster, which brings back 100 shields every 10 seconds. That's the general idea. And the reason why you typically don't see both is because if you are running an active tank, having more hit points will not help you rep more, whereas having resists on your ship will make the rep that you're bringing back a little more valuable. So it's typical you'll prioritize resists in that instance instead of like another armor plate or another shield extender. And if you're passive tanking, typically you either will not have room for an active, or you're in a situation where an active will not benefit you. That situation, the one that comes to mind for the most part, is fleet PvP. I'd say beyond like 15 to 20, certainly beyond 15 people. Because I've had an experience where I took 15 passive tankers versus 15 active tankers and kicked the crap out of them. So I'm confident with that number. And the reason is, there's quite the limit to your active tank as to how much it can pull back. It can pull back so much DPS and no more, and it only activates like once every so often. If you happen to die in between those cycles, you don't get the reps back. And if you're taking more DPS than your repper can handle, then your tank will go down. You will die. Sometimes you'll die before you can even activate one cycle. Whereas passive tanking, you're getting pounded on, yes, but you've got a lot of hit points there, and typically you'll pair passive tanking ships with logistic ships, which bring back armor more effectively than local tanks. Much more effectively. And you can have several logistic ships repping the same person, whereas if you're one player, you can typically only have 1 to 3 local tanking modules, and then you're capped out. You can have infinite number of players armor repping your passive setup, as long as you have enough hit points to survive the initial shot and let them get those reps on you. At that point, you're sitting pretty. And that's the basics of it. The one time that I ran up against this particular question in a practical PvP setup, we were training a corp of players that ran a wormhole, and we were taking them out into K-Space Losec for armor hack rooms. And so we had a 15-man Tech 3 and armor hack fleet, all passive tanks with, I think, 3 or 4 logistics, probably 4, I want to say. And we ran into a fleet of 15 battle cruisers, all active tank. They all had ancillary shield boosters. It was a mix of Gnosises, Cyclones, Hurricanes, and Drakes. And maybe 1 or 2 Oracles or something like that. And it was not even challenging. We took them on right on the gate. If they wanted to fight us, we wanted to fight them. It's not like either side thought it was an unfair fight. We jumped into them, and they activated their guns on us, and we went at it. I think we were taking the gate guns. And the first ship was a little hard. I think one of the Gnosises had a pretty decent tank. But once I saw that we could punch through it, then at that point it was just a matter of time. And the longer we were on field, the better it was for us, because we had stuff like neutralizers and ECM and stuff like that. Particularly the neutralizers, we could turn off their hardeners, which made their reppers even more ineffective. Whereas they could try to neut us, but it wasn't as important, because unless they neuted the logistic ships, which were pulling themselves away from the fight where they couldn't get neutered and where they were transferring capacitor to one another, so it was harder to neut them out. Well, they couldn't really do that to us. They could try to turn our hardeners off, but they weren't as cap dependent because we were armor ships.
I was going to say that's also a shield versus armor thing right there. Shield adaptive invulnerability fields require a lot more cap than the armor hardeners tend to. And you see a lot more completely passively tanked armor ships than you do shield ships.
So maybe if you want to talk by stats, the ships that tend to use shield tanking, Kaldari and Mimitar, have weaker capacitors than the Amar and Galintite. So even in absolute terms, it's easier to neut them out.
Yeah. I guess the one word of caution when you're thinking about fitting active tanks is you can sometimes shove an extra large ancillary shield booster on some fits, and that's not always a good idea, depending on how many fitting mods and compromises you have to make, and depending on how twitchy your repair is going to be, because you can end up in a situation where you're repairing like 75% of your shield every ASB cycle. So sure, you can rep a lot, but it's very, very bursty, and it's very, very vulnerable to alpha, or if your finger just slips. So that ends up being a higher skill, like player skill, rep technique.
Yeah, it must be said that like the physical like mechanics of moving your mouse around and keeping track of things for local tanking is considerably harder, because not only are you activating your guns and spamming your D-scan and evaluating your fleet and what the enemy ship is doing, but you also have to keep a careful eye on your hit points, your capacitor. And if you're using an ancillary shield booster or an ancillary armor repper, you have to keep in mind how many charges you've got left, because once those things run out, it's almost certain that you will die.
And that right there is why I don't like active fits, because I'm fundamentally bad at Eve in pretty much every way. And just adding that extra layer of complexity to a situation which is normally very complex in the first place just seems bad for somebody who is bad at the game like me.
I mean, can you imagine, like, if you're a, say, an active tanking sacrilege pilot, you've got to manage your missiles, your potentially ECM drones, which may or may not be going on the target that you're shooting, a neutralizer or smart bomb, which again may or may not be going on the person you're shooting, or may or may not be the right time to activate, depending. And then you've got to manage, like, your positioning and your transversal. You've got to manage watching your D-scan for new targets coming in that, you know, might signal that you have to leave. And on top of all that, you've got to manage your armor wrappers, which use capacitor. Like, there's no ancillary shield booster, which doesn't use capacitor. So even if you're using the ancillary armor wrapper, it still eats up cap, gives you a lot of rep for a certain amount of time, and then a decreased amount later when it runs out, but it still uses capacitor. So you've got to keep an eye on that. And that means you're going to have a cap booster. So you got to keep an eye on your cap booster, your armor wrapper, your ancillary armor wrappers, charge amount, and all that stuff together at once while you're fighting somebody. And can you imagine doing all that when you have to fight 30-something people, let alone if you have to FC 30-something people fighting something there, 30-something people? Like, it's just, as Andrew was saying, it's an entirely needless layer of complexity to an already complex situation. So that's the thing. But on the other hand, to say a good thing about local tanking, local tanking, if you can rep more than the incoming damage, you can potentially kill a lot more players than you would under a passive tank ship. So, for instance, a Cyclone with a regular shield booster can easily solo 3, 4, perhaps even 5 battle cruisers. You know, it fights 2 or 3 of them at a time, kills the one, then the other two can't break it, so it kills them, maybe more stuff warps in. You see PvP videos like this all the time on YouTube from guys like Prometheus Exenthal and Garmin. And Kill 2, back when he was doing that, that's what they relied on. And it's quite effective. You can pull off some pretty impressive fights with local tanks. It's just, you really have to know your limits, and it's extremely demanding on your skills and attention as a player. I think for the next cast, we'll talk about shield versus armor and the different ways that plays out in various types of fights in EVE. But that's it for 62. Go to decorationsofwar.com to participate in the show poll, leave a comment, or put in a donation. We have a really cool new donation button that you guys can use that makes the whole thing a bit easier and looks better on the site, quite frankly.
RMT.
How many Ishikone Watch Scorpions have you gotten for SCL and for being the number one CCP certified podcast there?
Not enough. I'd love to turn that number from a 0 to a 1 if somebody wants to make my dreams come true.
Please. I could give and no fucks about the Ishikone Watch Scorpion. You know what I want? That's not nearly as valuable, but in my mind twice as cool. Somebody give me a Chronos, man. The new Chronos effect coming in Rubicon is amazing.
Dude, I couldn't give two shits about the Ishikone Watch Scorpion, mate. I could give plenty of shits for the ISK that I would trade it for.
Fair enough. Definitely check out our store link. You can find it on the website. It's also www.welovefine.com/eve. And you can get Decorations of War shirts. You can even get a Crossing Zebra shirt if you want to, you know, do a pity donation to Xander here. He could probably use some shirt sales, I'm sure. You can reach Noir via our public channel, Cafe Noir Dot, and apply to join us or Noir Academy on our forums at www.noirmarks.com. And definitely check out crossingzebras.com if you're not already subscribed. All kidding aside, Xander has one of the best podcasts out there, and I highly recommend everybody listen to him. Fly safe, everybody.
Yeah. A used pink bathrobe, a rare mint snow globe, a Smurf TV tray.
bought on eBay. My house is filled with this crap. Shows up in bubble wrap most every day. What I bought on eBay. Tell me why I need another pet rock. Tell me why I got that Alpha alarm clock. Tell me why I bid on Shatner's old toupee. They had it on eBay. I buy your knick-knack, just check. Is liable to snipe you with 2 seconds left to go. Whoa, got PayPal or Visa, whatever'll please ya, as long as I've got the dough. I'll buy your tchotchkes, sell me your watch, please. I'll buy. Some vintage tube socks, wanna buy.